Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is the program of the Genesis 123 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we're also going to share an exciting opportunity. And please feel free to share this with others who you know will also find it of interest. Today, I'm really excited to have back as a guest Rabbi Moshe Tarragon. I think three times we've had Rabbi Tarragon on Inspiration from Zion, and except for sitting next to each other once at a morning house, a shiva house, exactly a year ago, and not connecting because that was an inappropriate time, we've actually never met in person. But I have the real privilege of following Rabbi Tarragon at least through regular columns that he writes in the Jerusalem Post. Let me introduce him again, if you're not familiar. And I want to get into the conversation, because as we've done, unfortunately, since October 7th, all of the episodes are related in one way or another to the war that began that day, the conflict, the battle, which is unfortunately still going on. Rabbi Tarragon has been a rabbinic instructor at Yeshivat Har Etzion in Gush Etzion, which is where we both live, the last 30 years. He has rabbinic ordination from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary in New York, and a BA in computer science from Yeshiva College, also in New York, and a master's in English literature from City University, also in New York. Rabbi Tarragon previously taught Talmud at Columbia University and lectured in Talmud and Bible at Yeshiva University, and served as the assistant rabbi at the very well-known synagogue, the Fifth Avenue Synagogue in New York. In addition, Rabbi Tarragon currently teaches at the Stella K. Abraham Beit Midrash for Women of Yeshivat Har Etzion, which is here in Migdal Oz, in between where he and I both live. He's the author of an internet shiur, teachings, entitled Talmudic Methodology, with over 5,000 subscribers, and a weekly teaching on Pirkei Avot, the lessons of the forefathers, with over 1,400 subscribers, and has delivered hundreds of audio lessons featured on the Yeshivat Har Etzion audio Beit Midrash, as well as Yeshiva University Torah Online. Rabbi Tarragon has authored a Yom HaTzma'ut Machzor. And for those who are not familiar with the term, Yom HaTzma'ut is Israel's Independence Day, which is coming up in just a few weeks. And the Machzor is a special prayer book that we have for festival occasions and biblical festivals. This was published in conjunction with Koren Publishing, and he is currently authoring another book entitled Reclaiming Redemption, Deciphering the Mystery of Jewish History. In addition, he's a weekly columnist, as I mentioned, for the Jerusalem Post on issues relating to religion and modernity, and also authors a weekly column for the Orthodox Union Israel Torah Journal entitled Geulas Yisrael, which would be the redemption of Israel. Rabbi Tarragon and his wife have 8 children and reside in Gush Etzion, here in where I live. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Tarragon, last time we had you on, it was the week before your daughter's wedding?
Probably. About a year ago. A little more than a year.
Oh, then maybe we had you before. I don't remember. But I'm really glad that we connected and you shared with me about the new book this week, and that we're having a conversation, because it's really important and you're bringing a very important dimension into the conversation generally about the situation in which we find ourselves today, but also I think raising the bar quite a bit. So thanks for taking the time today and joining us back on Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's good to be here. And thank you, and welcome again to the audience. Nice to reach out and and join people who are people of spirit and people who understand that we're living through an important moment in history. And in particular, today is April 14, 2024, and though my book addressed issues of faith, morality, and cultural struggles over the last 6 months, last night was a historic evening in which God allowed man to scale the heavens and protect himself from those people of evil, people of death who would just want to indiscriminately kill innocent civilians. Our country was attacked savagely by a barrage of a fusillade of missiles from Iran, and that we defended ourselves with the technology that God has taught us to wield and taught us to advance. So I don't know if they were to talk about that now, but it's certainly a very propitious moment for us to be speaking with one another, and I hope that God will continue to show us his protection and grace.
It's a very significant moment, as you said, and I wonder maybe in the course of the conversation how the book is published now. So you're not making any more edits, but I'm curious when we go through the conversation, maybe we'll talk about maybe what you would have done different, knowing what now is happening, and by the time this episode comes out, what yet may happen. But let's jump in. The book is called Dark Clouds Above, Faith Below. What was the genesis for this? Where did it come together? Because 6 months is not a very long time to publish a book.
Look, it's a great question. It's an important question to go back to the Genesis, the Batman Begins story. What happened to our people on October 7th was an apocalyptic event. So many of our preconceived notions, not just militarily and politically, but morally and religiously, about a new period in history in which the people of God have been returned to the land of God. And so much of the ugly and scarred history of the last 2,000 years of violence and discrimination and bigotry and anti-Semitism, we thought, some thought, maybe naively, that that period was a relic of a tortured Jewish past and a tortured past for humanity, because anti-Semitism is the ugly scar of humanity, and it's a hatred that ignites other hatreds. And any society or culture that foments anti-Semitism ultimately collapses in on itself, because it devours itself with hatred and with contempt. So we thought a lot of that had been relegated to the past, and we lived in an enlightened world of international diplomacy and multiculturalism and respect for the dignity of life. And the savagery and the barbarism, the mutilation, the rape, the incineration, the wanton violence and masochism, we just weren't prepared. It feels like it came from the 13th century or came out of the 9th century where people acted as barbarians. And so many of our preconceptions changed, and quite frankly, it's fair to ask, and it's important to ask, where was God on October 7th? Where was God on our Sabbath? Where was God on the day the Jews around the world celebrate being chosen to receive and to apply God's will? So in the aftermath of that, in addition to facing the military struggle, the security challenge, the political challenge, I felt that there were layers to explore beyond ideological layers. I felt as if this was a four-layered war. There's the actual war that was unfolding in Gaza. There is a religious theological war about the face of God in our world, about what culture feels about life and the dignity of life. The third war is, of course, the war of anti-Semitism, is out of nowhere. This monster was awakened, and people are fomenting death to Jews. And then the fourth tier is somehow all these cultural narratives that trouble people of traditional value systems, what we call wokeism and hyperliberalism, have become weaponized against their people. So I started to write. And I started to write to explore my own feelings and to share some of my own streams of consciousness in my various columns. And then about 2 or 3 months ago, I said, why don't we just assemble them, put them together into a book, so that there's one corpus and one body for people to access deeper meanings and deeper layers to the war, aside from just the reports of tanks and of guns and of battlefields and Gaza.
Yeah, very good. And I mentioned to you when you reached out to share with me about the book that I was disappointed because I so much look forward to reading your columns in the Jerusalem Post. And this past weekend I was away, which meant I knew I wouldn't get to my normal reading on Shabbat to do that. And I haven't yet, but I will. I know you sent me that. What surprised you the most? The book digs into a lot of very important issues, and you're going deep and wide, it seems. But what surprised you the most on October 7th and in the aftermath?
It's such an insightful question, and it's so hard because it's almost as if there's pre-war and post-war, similar to Corona in many ways, but it was more transformational than Corona. People say they can't imagine their lives before Corona, having lived through Corona. We thought the world had shifted and pivoted, and then 3 years after the Corona epidemic, it shifted again, especially for Jews living in Israel, right under our feet. What surprised me on October 7th, as I said before, these are scenes from shtetls in Eastern Europe, European capitals of the dark Middle Ages, from backward Arab cities throughout history, blood libels, defenseless Jews being tortured, being raped without anyone to defend them. And we knew that we had a struggle in Israel. Our return to Israel hasn't been widely and internationally embraced. People of faith have, still people who refuse, deny the place of God in this world haven't. That will change. We're people of faith. We know that one day it will change. But our battles have been facing terror, facing armies. But these were scenes that we just cut and paste from so much of our black and dark past. And as a person of faith, I thought we were in a different stage of history. On the other hand, I will say that though the scenes were reminiscent of the pogroms and the blood libels and the riots that our people faced throughout history, this was the first pogrom in history that was followed by a war.
Wow. True.
Every pogrom in history, we just licked our wounds and waited for the next one. So as painful as it was reflective of a new era. And now we were able and willing, with people of good spirit and good moral conscience, to defend ourselves and to fight a just and moral war, despite the naysayers who will accuse us of ridiculous crimes.
I want
I
to get
don't
into the. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's fine. I'm pretty.
I want to get into the book, but there's something very deep here because if I'm putting words in your mouth correctly, you were surprised that in the sense that you thought we were beyond that. But Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, they've never made any secrets about it. Is it are we really should we really have been surprised?
I think you're asking that question from a political and military standpoint. And I think there are a lot of people who think that those establishments failed to read the tea leaves and were too overconfident in technology and were too overconfident in the assessments of our intel. But I'm not a political analyst and I'm not a diplomat. So for me, my angle is always, how could God allow this? How could God, regardless of whatever man, human decisions are, regardless of whatever human failures are, I believe there are metaphysical forces that are at play and historical forces that are authored in a divine fashion. And I thought that God had already, with the end of the Holocaust and the return of the people of Israel to the land of Israel, that these scenes would no longer repeat themselves. And that was the question that I struggled with. How could God have allowed a Kurdistan?
And do you have an answer?
No, I don't.
How do you square the circle with God allowing that in our day?
I walk back to Mount Moriah and I stand where Abraham stood, and I realize that sometimes you face an incomprehensible mystery called God. Sometimes you understand him. But to be honest, I'm still processing because I think I didn't see God on October 7th, but I saw God on April 13th. I see anyone who was living in Israel last night saw the hand of God. And our challenge is to calibrate. Sometimes we'll see him, and sometimes we won't. And even when we don't see him, I think you can see him through the cracks of history. Maybe the larger tragedy of October 7th obscured the presence of God. Well, there's so many stories of heroism, and it could have been much worse. For some reason, Hezbollah didn't join, and they had plans to cut through the center of our country. But sometimes it's hard for human beings to parse the ways of God and the divine justice. And at that point, humility sets in, and we just stand before God with faith. As the fourth child who doesn't know how to ask questions on Passover, we don't always know how to even ask the questions, but faith buoys us and keeps us standing.
Certainly not as soon as 6 plus months. The questions are difficult. I've had this conversation a lot because many of my Christian friends from the beginning, with all of the interviews and briefings I've done, have asked me about my faith. I've never had this conversation with a rabbi, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. I didn't have a good answer until I had to really contemplate where do I stand? I mean, your question is, where was God? So I have to ask about my own faith. And we're here now this year. You're here in Israel a bit longer than I am. We're here this summer 20 years. And that makes us veterans, but I still feel very new in a sense. And what I realized for the first time is that being here in Israel, yes, God promised he was going to bring us back, and we're living that and all of the prophecies and blessings that go along with it. But I don't know a place, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, where God says, hey, we're going to make it really easy for you too. And the second thing that I'm embracing that and saying, okay, we're getting the gift, but it doesn't mean that you might not get a paper cut when you're opening it, or that sometimes it won't break, or other things of that nature. And the other piece that, as I'm reading my Bible, now we're almost midway through the cycle that was beginning that week 6 months ago. I'm looking at the wars that we fought and were subject to. I'm looking that there were men, more or less your age and my age, who would be fighting, and maybe there are exceptions to this, but we don't know their names. We don't know who was killed. We don't know who had something amputated, and how they were feeling. And for me, that's a strange comfort. Not that we are living in a biblical time, we're not, but it's a sequel, if you will, to the wars that we fought. And that gives me comfort. And I want to talk something more personal toward the end, if I remember. Thank God for me personally, the war has been as close as my son and son-in-law being in Gaza, and the trauma that that has instilled, and the trauma that they've lived through. But I'm wondering, what do you think about me, Jonathan's idea that, hey, we'll look at the biblical wars against the Amalekites and the Moabites and all the other ites, and say that, yeah, this is just the norm, and it's how it's meant to be. Does that make sense?
Oh wow! Look, faith makes sense on a personal level. There's no formula for faith. Let's start from the beginning. I think first of all, it's always important to keep perspective. As I said before, there was a terrible pogrom on October 7th, but then there was a war that followed, and every one of our grandparents would give their right arm to trade places with us.
Yes.
And just think of it this way: a lot of people find the equation between October 7th and the Holocaust abrasive. I guess the best way I could start to introduce what the Holocaust was like is to call it a 5-year October 7th.
Yes.
Imagine October 7th lasted 5 years and then there was no war in response to the outrage and the atrocity. So we have advanced in history, and despite the setback of October 7th, we are still surging, and history is still hurtling forward toward this inevitable terminus. History has a beginning, history has an end. The beginning is called creation. The end is called redemption, and we live in the middle, and we can affect the end and advance the end by our behavior and our decisions. Just the sky's not falling. In terms of your own perspective, looking back to the past, it's absolutely true. People that live faith live intergenerationally. They live with verticality. They live connected to people before them and people after them. And without question, legacy and destiny. Legacy is our past, destiny is our future. Each of them provide spirit to help us stabilize the frustrations of the present. So people of faith don't just live in the present. They feel that they're part of a community of those that have come before them and a community of those that will come after them. One day, Jonathan, your picture and my picture will be on walls, and those pictures will tell stories. And we are aware that we will be storytellers long after we depart this earth, so we're conscious of the stories we're writing. I don't agree that our identity is bellicose. Those wars were parenthetical to history. We're not a very militant people. Of course, we know how to defend ourselves, but we don't invite wars. And the irony in all of Jewish history is ironic, is that we're being depicted as a bellicose, militant, aggressive,
Right.
fundamentalist. That's certainly far from our identity. We're placed on this earth to be teachers. We're placed on this earth to inspire humanity. We're placed on this earth to model a godlike lifestyle. At that stage in history, we have to empty the country of paganists and idolatrous and blood drinkers and blood suckers and cannibals. But by and large, we don't court war. I think faith is, getting back to your original question, one of my rabbis, the rabbi that inspired my life, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein, who I had the privilege to study with, wrote a seminal article. I'm obviously not going to quote the article, but the title says it all. He says, "The source of faith is faith itself."
Oh.
Like a riddle, But what I take it to mean is it's not logical, it's not empirical. You meet great people, you learn from them, you watch them, and you are willing to suspend your own analysis because
Wow.
they've held you with something that you believe in beyond ration. I don't love my wife because of ration. It's not like I could break it down to a formula. There's something deep inside of me that I know is there, and I know exists, and it's unconditional and it's comprehensive. And if religion trickles down to that level of identity, you love and believe in God, regardless of what happens in this world. We've seen enough in this world to know
Tremendous. Thank you.
that.
That's excellent. I want to take a break and come back in and start talking about your book, but let's just take a really quick break first. The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today. Okay, Rabbi Tarragon, we could go on and on. I'm so grateful for you making this time. Dark clouds above, faith below. Help break the. Well, I want you to break it down, but you're an Orthodox rabbi teaching in multiple Orthodox Jewish institutions with a wide breadth of knowledge, not just about Judaism. But the book is written very much in a Jewish, from a Jewish perspective, yes?
It's written from, I never want to suspend my voice. I think that would be disingenuous. I never want to pander. I never want to present myself as something I'm not. But I deeply believe that the value system that I subscribe to and that I try to shape my life around has universal appeal. And I think that universalism sits at the heart of every Jew. I'll never abdicate that conviction. I'm always
Sure.
looking for a language and a meter, a yardstick to find the value. Obviously, the details of the Talmudic passage may not have universal currency. I won't share that with my readership. Certainly, the articles I write for the Jerusalem Post, they're extended not just to Orthodox Jews, but to non and even to non-Jews across the world who need it, who want to know, as your podcast provides, who want to know the arc of the Jews returning to their home, the trajectory of history. I'll try to share those values as broadly as I can, and but I'm not going to flinch from my background or from my
Good.
grammar, because that would be presenting an imposter.
Well, but also I was going to ask about the language before. Obviously, I haven't read the book. I read many of the articles, but I haven't read the book yet, and I'm going to hopefully get a chance to do that soon. But for somebody who's not as familiar, what do you say to them before they go and buy the book so they're not frustrated that, wow, this is a lot of language and concepts that I don't understand?
I would say two things. Again, it's hard for me to answer that question honestly because I am familiar and I understand the terminology being presented. I would say two things. I would say focus on two particular dimensions of the book, which I think are even more universal than the rest of the book. One question, and we could certainly discuss this, is how is this battle, how is this war revealing the different ways that the Islamic fundamentalists or the Islamic culture views God, religion, afterlife, value of life, and how do we in the Judeo-Christian worldview? So this is a theological, religious struggle about the face of God and the face of religion in our world. And hopefully those articles that address those issues will be more resonant than maybe articles that are more directly connected to a classic Torah content.
Got it.
The second dimension of the book is we all feel that over the last, let's say, over the last 40 years, We feel that there has been a cascading decline in cultural, communal values and identity. What has caused it? Perhaps democracy, capitalism has bred individualism, individual expression. Individual expression discourages commitment and conforming to general values of identity, of religion, of value, of morality. Part of it has been the horrors of the 20th century. People saw the nightmare of Nazi fascism and other forms of the Soviet persecution. They became very queasy about any attempt to create common values that would capture communities. Now that there's a rampant distaste for any common value that has bred multiculturalism, where every culture is accepted and every value is promoted. Probably the third part is the internet. The internet is was supposed to democratize knowledge and information, but unfortunately it created group and herd mentality, and it's robbed us of community. 40, 50 years ago, you lived in a community and you watched your neighbors and the way they behaved and the way they went to church or synagogue and the way they conducted themselves in the general store and the way they behaved in the bank. Today, the community and all activities are have been replaced by the internet. You shop on Amazon in a faceless fashion. You perform your banking on your online bank in a faceless fashion. You shop for your food in a large supermarket. So somehow this trifecta, namely the rampant individualism, the distaste for overtly and aggressive forms of value of identity forming, and finally the lack of community, we feel that a lot of values, family values, gender identity, morality have slowly been disintegrating. And all of a sudden, many of these cultural narratives and cultural wars, wokeism and hyperliberalism and multiculturalism, somehow they've all become weaponized to be used in this battle against the Jewish people. So I feel there's a cultural battle, and I'm not surprised because
Yes.
our task in this world is to bring God into this world and to repair wherever the culture has been fissured and splintered by misguided truths. So I would encourage the readers to be sensitive to those two areas in the book.
So let's talk about them. Let's talk about, first about Islam. Yesterday, October 7th, of course, was a horrific example of the worst of Islam, I would say. Yesterday was maybe a notch below, only because they were not successful, not because they didn't try and send hundreds of rockets that could have done the damage much more if they had hit their targets. What do we need to do to begin to unpack the nature of Islam from a Jewish and Christian perspective?
Well, wow. Oh, look, it's a large question. I'll break it down into three, and I'll discuss each one at a time, and then please comment and respond and elaborate.
Okay.
Number one, is God angry or is God merciful? It took humanity 2,000 years to discover that God was merciful and compassionate, because the ancients only saw death, floods, population expulsion, dispersal, Adam and Cain, Noah. And they thought that gods were these grotesque figures in heaven who toyed with human playthings for fun and for sport. And Abraham's great discovery was that God is kind and compassionate, and that he wants human welfare. He desires human prosperity. And this has become the great Judeo-Christian value, that God wants human beings to prosper. And those who have bought into this value system live advanced lives, live lives of medical advanced medical treatment, higher education, economic equality, and those who are still stuck in the quagmire of paganism, they don't. Now, Islam belongs to the Abrahamic tradition, but it lost its way. There's an interesting book I recommend to all the readers, written by a Middle Eastern historian called Bernard Lewis. It was actually written before 2001, but it was published only after. And he asks a very haunting question: what went wrong? That's the name of the book. How did Islamic culture abdicate its supremacy in so many areas, economics, politics, commerce, science, philosophy, art, which is the subject, which is the trigger of such Islamic rage? And he tackles the question from socio, historical, economic perspectives. I'm a religious person. I answer every question in life religiously. And to me, when I imagine when a Christian sees the world and sees suffering, we are driven by our image of God as merciful to try to re-landscape our world in the image of our God and to alleviate suffering and distress, because we believe God wants us to discover, to advance, to innovate. But in Muslim views, his God is angry and vengeful and bloodlusting and arbitrary. So when they see suffering in this world, there's absolutely no religious impetus to alleviate suffering because God is arbitrary and God is unpredictable. And that's why I believe the Islamic culture has yet to progress in the same manner that the Jewish and Christian culture has. And their greatest contribution over the last 100 years, sadly, has been terrorism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that you just said they have yet to progress. Do you have hope that they will? Or are you just being politically correct?
That's a good question. Like our apocalypse, when I say our apocalypse, I mean the Jewish version of apocalypse does not mean the elimination of every single human being from this earth, aside from the Jews. People of morality, of moral conscience, people of spirit, people who are willing to accept God's presence either have already or will see God when he reveals himself, they'll survive. And other people will not, people of evil, people who defy God's presence. So it's hard for me as a humanist, I think every religious person at their heart is a humanist, to imagine this large scale annihilation of billions of people. That doesn't jive with my humanist tendencies. On the same token, many Muslims today deeply, deeply resent us, resent Jews, resent Christians, resent the historical arc that we've begun. So I'm a little bit torn, and I'd rather be torn than to say something which betrays either of my deep beliefs.
Okay, excellent. You had mentioned two others. Is God angry or merciful?
And second of all, we don't have a death wish. Our culture does not celebrate death. Our culture does not pursue death. When Jews sanctify themselves and offer their lives in defense of their belief, it's not something we pursue. It's not something we herald. Our job or our task in this world is to present God in this world with every ounce of our energy and to be committed to that lifestyle more than we care about our own comfort. Very often, boys, I teach 18-year-old boys as my primary profession, will ask me to describe passion. I'll say, passion is you care for something more deeply than you care for yourself and your comfort. And the reflection of passion is that you're willing to die for something if push comes to shove. Push came to shove, I'd be willing to die for my God. I'd be willing to die for my people. I'd be willing to die for my family. I don't have a death wish. I hope to live a long life for my God, for my people.
Excellent.
But if I weren't willing to die, then my passion really wouldn't be complete. So the one culture celebrates death and one culture celebrates life. And you can't get to the next world by committing homicide and genocide in this world. And essentially, it doesn't just affect the way you view life, it affects the way you view the afterlife. We're not looking for 72 virgins. We're looking for a life before God that we'll enjoy in the next world and that we build in this world. There's a very famous English poet called Henry Drummond, who once said that to get to heaven, we have to take it there with us. So we're building our heaven on this earth, and then we move to the next world, and there's a continuity between this world and the next world. The suggestion that you can get to the next world by killing people establishes discontinuity and disintegration. You commit a crime in this world and get to the next world, and it casts the entire afterlife as just some carnal pleasure of celebrating sexual desire and gluttony. It's so consistent with the godlike lifestyle that we pursue.
Is there an exception
And
to what you're saying about Islam celebrating or aspiring to death? Or is that is there, from your perspective, is that just a very broad, true, even in the most, if you will, enlightened Islamic communities?
no, I should have been careful. I meant Islamic fundamentalism.
Okay.
Now, I'm not enough of an expert to draw that careful line between Islamic fundamentalism and Islam and how much of it is textually based and how much of it isn't. Many will claim that it's latent in the Quran. Many will claim it isn't. That's not my field of expertise. So I meant Islamic fundamentalism.
Which we see in our neighbors and yesterday in
Just,
Iran.
yeah, I mean, just last week we saw that one of the terrible, heinous criminals of Hamas, who is now safe sheltering in Qatar while his people are suffering in Gaza, is Bilal Hania. He was told that three of his children and some of his grandchildren were sent to their maker in an airstrike. And if you just take a few steps back because he's a horrible criminal, his response was odious. He smiled, he waved to the cameras, just at a human level. If I weren't a Jew living in Israel, it would be such a horrific response because he was just happy that his children and grandchildren have met death. And we're not happy about death, although we face it with steely, conviction and stately courage.
Excellent
Yeah.
distinction. Thank you. And there's a third point you wanted to make about Islam.
And the third point is something which
Islamic extremism.
unfortunately we saw the mutilation of bodies, the disrespect, or we believe that God is different from nature. That's what makes us monotheists. God is not part of nature. If he were, that would be pantheism. He's distinct from nature, and he is different from nature. And he bestowed and endowed difference upon one creature to be like him. Just like he is different, we are different. We're not dogs, we're not cats, we're not trees, we're not molecules. He bestowed us with differences that are in his image, divine image. And you can go through all of those traits that we have that animals don't: intelligence, creativity, emotions, consciousness, dreams, ration, but we're different. Because of that, and I alluded to this before, we respect every human being as a divine masterpiece with divine potential, and we respect them, not just their immortal soul, but the material body which houses that soul during their time on this earth. And just the people who dedicated their lives to collecting remains, to seeing sights that I think will torture them for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
I didn't have the challenge to walk through some of these burnt communities and incinerated homes and mutilated bodies, but I think these people saw sights that will haunt their nightmares forever. Not to mention people who collected bodies under fire in the middle of battle. But that's who we are. We respect life, and we also show dignity to the body that cradles life while it exists on this earth. And it's not just a moral issue, the dignity of the human condition. As I mentioned before, affording dignity to human beings is an affirmation of God as creator of this universe and God as creator of human beings. So essentially, let me just summarize. These are religious imposters. They look like Islamic fundamentalists, look like religious leaders. They dress like religious leaders. They wear turbans. Don't be fooled. They're atheists, because denying the ways of God is tantamount to denying God himself.
Wow, that's
Because
radical, but true.
it doesn't exist. Their God doesn't exist, and people of religion have to see through them and stop referencing them as religious leaders. They're not.
Excellent. You know, when you're talking, it's for another conversation, perhaps, and I'd love any followers to write in any questions on it, but you're talking about the sanctity of life and respect for the dead, and that was one of the challenges for some time after October 7th. I was down with a group from New Mexico recently in the Gaza border area, and one of the things that I saw for the first time was, I don't know if there's a name for it, but I'll just call it the graveyard for all the cars, the vehicles that were torched, where people were killed in them. And the reason that they're all sitting there, I think, is because we don't even still yet know what to do with many of them, which still have human remains that can't just be recycled and dumped, but too vast to be buried.
The dignity of human life. That's what separates us from beasts of the jungle, quite frankly.
This is a fascinating conversation, Rabbi Tarek, and I want to take another quick break and come back, and then we'll go into the issue, which maybe we it's your book, so you probably set it up in a sophisticated way, but you're talking about the cultural battle, but taking extremist Islam first. But let's take a quick break. Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better, much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones. Great. So, Rabbi Tarragon, that was really fascinating on radical Islam. But we're now seeing a battle from the other side, and that's been progressing in the last decade or two, or perhaps a few more. You referred to multiculturalism, wokeism, progressivism. How does that fit into these are things that will be red meat for some people listening because of the hatred for the way that society is becoming like that. But you put it into the context of a book that was written subsequent to October 7th. How does that fit in?
Look, it's a wonderful question. I think, again, as I said earlier, for people of faith, everything fits in. And history isn't aimless, and cultural narratives or cultural trajectories aren't arbitrary. And if culture is starting to unravel, and we believe it is over the last three, 4 decades, because of the issues I spoke about before, rampant individualism and suspicion of conforming social ideas and the ravages of the internet and the decommunalizing of the effect of the internet, I think that we have to see ourselves as responsible to repair the culture. I'm not surprised that all these wokeism or hyper-progressive ideas are being spewed with venom, venomous, to attack our people and to attack those who will support our people. I think one of the fissures of our modern culture is herd mentality, where people are afraid to think for themselves. The internet has cultivated herd mentality. We see a video, and it's a viral video that 15 million people have seen. So something within us compels us to watch that video because it must have content if 15 million have seen it, or the generating of likes on social media. And I think a lot of people who are protesting don't know what they're talking about. They're completely ignorant, but they're afraid not to belong to the herd, not to belong to the herd. I think a lot of them are stooges who are being duped. I think there are a lot of professors on campuses who are just afraid to stand up for what's right because they feel that the career or the tenure will be threatened. So I don't think that all of the anti-Israel bashers and all those who spew hatred and violence are all cut from the same cloth. It's a consortium of different groups, haters, violent people, like everything else. People are just afraid to stand up and make a difference. So I think that there's a lot of groupthink.
What's not Jewish about that? What's glaring about this, not just the breakdown of culture, but the herd mentality and latching on to what other people are saying and doing?
Well, one of the boldest expressions of divine image, which we discussed a little bit earlier, is freedom of conscience and free will and freedom of decision and to apply the intelligence that God gifted us with to arrive at just and morally balanced decisions. And the fomenting and the incitement towards violence and it's completely uninformed. Many of the people who are protesting, and you ask them, which river and sea are you referring to? They'll say the Mississippi River or the Pacific Ocean. And it's just mindlessly led into supporting a lot of his intersectionality, this horrible, horrible concept. It's a product of the 70s, in which the world is divided into people of power and people who are oppressed. And anyone who's oppressed is part of the same alliance. And it's a very dark and, to be honest, very Marxist view of history. Karl Marx divided the world into the working class and the management class, and it's a constant battle. God didn't create a world of anger, tension, and battle. We're not meant to perpetuate battles. We're meant to create peace and harmony and cooperation. It's so anti-Jewish. It's so anti-Christian. It's so anti God's divine will to paint the world in oppressors and victims. And the corollary is, well, everyone who was oppressed, who was aggrieved, was part of the same front, then you have a responsibility to support any other person you feel is being discriminated against. So if, let's say, you're an African American housewife in Detroit who feels you're being discriminated against, it is your moral responsibility not just to protest for your own rights and for the rights of other African American housewives, but to protest on behalf of what you perceive are aggrieved Palestinians in Gaza, even without any knowledge, without any perspective, not knowing where Gaza is, not knowing the history. It's a moral collapse.
Excellent. Where, so how have you woven that into this book? I like to get some specific examples.
Tried to trace it to different parts of the Bible. For example, parts of the Bible, and as you said before, most of this book, if not all of the book, was written in the first half of our yearly Bible reading cycle. So most of it centers around sections in Genesis, sections in the beginning of Exodus, and then I published the book halfway through Exodus. So anything that I've written after the second half of Exodus is not in this book. But I've tried to tether, I think the Bible has eternal truths. And every time you read the Bible, you look at it through different lenses. And now we're looking at it through post-October 7th lenses. So for example, Jacob's struggle for truth. And no matter how hard he tries, his father-in-law, Laban, accuses him of chicanery and treason and deceit, and he's an honest person alive. He'll bend over backwards, to be honest. And at some point, he just lets him have it. He just comes clean in the end of his that fateful rendezvous as he's fleeing back to his father's house in the land of Canaan. And he just stands up and he says, you've been switching my salary endlessly. You've been lying to me. There is something called absolute truth in this world, and it can't be photoshopped. And it can't be contextualized. And this is one of the great, great crimes of postmodernism. The postmodern world, truth is a social construct. There is no absolute fixed norm. It's a truth, it's a social construct that each culture and each society builds to create its agenda. And therefore, there is no absolute moral truth. There is no fixed norm. And everything has to be seen as Caroline Gay and some of the other esteemed members of our academic society would have us believe everything has to be put into context, which is the perversion. The vision of God's will.
Is there a
And
particular event or topic or issue relating to morality and how the war is being depicted? And it still is. It's not a past tense, which makes the book, I think, that much more urgent because we can still shift the narrative. But is there something specific that in the context of this multiculturalism, cultural battle, the what's the word? I just lost it.
intersectionality.
Intersectionality, sorry. I was up a lot last night because of this situation. That you can highlight so people understand how it applies to what we're the situation and the period we're talking about.
I think everyone comes to it from their own cultural perspective, and I think a believing Christian in Corpus Christi will see it differently than a believing Jew in Gush Etzion. But I think for all of us, the shock of the that hearing, the congressional hearing, with three or four Ivy League deans. And not what they said. What they said I related to earlier, contextualizing rabid calls to violence and inciting to murder. But in general, the way that we idolize institutions of upper learning and upper knowledge, I don't idolize them, but our culture does. And it sent a sobering reminder of the following equation being false. People sometimes make the equation that knowledge equals moral spirit and moral improvement. And there was an assumption that our culture was built upon the smarter you are, the more knowledge you acquire, the more you study, the more perspective, the more you think about eternal values, the greater your moral disposition. And we're discovering that sometimes too much knowledge can create moral swirl, too much knowledge can create moral confusion. Too much knowledge can create intellectual arrogance where they're too smart for their own good and they can't see the world through clear binary lenses of good and evil and black and white, paralysis by analysis, and everything has to be analyzed and contextualized. And I think it reaffirms what a lot of simple people like myself and yourself believe to be true, that in addition to studying the world around us and gaining moral conscience, we should just look inside to the moral spirit that God placed within us. And that doesn't need education. That doesn't need sophistication. Sometimes sophistication disturbs what God has placed innately in the human heart.
Excellent. What other areas? We're running out of time, and I don't want to give away everything. I like people to actually buy the book and read it. By the way, so I don't forget, because it's something I'm not really good at. I don't want to forget. Where can people buy your book?
The book is available both from the publisher as well as on Amazon, but I'll send you the link and I'm sure you can post it even when you record it. Do you want me to send you the link now or can send it after
No,
the
you'll
meeting?
send the link and we'll put it in the show notes. But I want to remind people that the title is Dark Clouds Above, Faith Below. And the publisher is
Kodesh.
Kodesh, Kodesh Press. Terrific. So what other broad areas, when they buy your book, are people going to get to read about, and what do you want them to know before they get the book?
Look, there's an entire section that I think will resonate with many of your readers, which we haven't really grazed. And I'll just refer to it as, what does this all say about anti-Semitism? How do we better understand anti-Semitism in an enlightened world in which we thought that that devil had already been slain and that that scourge of humanity had already been defeated? What does it say about humanity? What does it say about modern culture? What does it say about religious culture? That's something which is obviously too large for us to begin to untangle at this stage. But it's certainly something I want the readers to be able to look back at history, recognize that, for example, anti-Semitism always has a cover story. Anti-Semitism will always adopt a popular cultural storyline to sell genocide, whether it's social Darwinism, whether it's the classic Christian anti-Semitism driven by the false notion that Jews killed Jesus, whether it is, of course, the common false adaptation of colonialism. Colonialism is a horrible period in history. For the 400 years, your selfish, egocentric European monarchs bled third world countries dry of resources and labor for their own ostentatious needs. It was a black mark in history. But we're not colonialists. We're victims of colonialism, like anyone else. We're victims of the British rule in our own homeland. But it's the sickness and the pathology of anti-Semitism that it dupes humanity into believing that genocide is legitimate because it foments fear and foments dread by adopting very, very powerful cultural storylines.
Thank you. What in all of this, I don't know if it's in the book or not, what gives you comfort now, past six months past October 7th? What gives you comfort in processing it all? We're still processing, and we're still in the midst of a war that by the time people are listening to this may be much worse than it ha had been even at the outset.
Look, it depends which day you ask me. And I'm sure everyone has a different answer for that. But I still go back to what I said before. God in history. God is my shepherd, literally, and I walk with him in moments of light, in moments of darkness, moments of clarity, in moments of mystery, moments that are like last night, moments that are like 6 months ago. And man is not expected to always understand God. His ways are not our ways, his thoughts are not our thoughts. But thank God I feel his presence more so than I've ever felt him in my life. So I'm speaking with him on a daily basis, arguing with him, questioning him, not understanding, but reaching out to the abyss, reaching out, as you said before, when my kids were in Gaza, fighting this battle, fighting in Gaza. And I reach out to him without any analysis, just with grief and with fear and with need. And I felt as if he was holding my hand and supporting me. So I think having God in your life helps as best as you can check with you through moments of difficulty. And the second point is history, to know that I'm part of something larger. And my story is only a chapter of a larger story. And if my story ends abruptly, God forbid, or other parts of my story, the larger story is sure, the larger story, we know how it ends. We know exactly where history is ending and how it's ending. The question is who will carry it to its conclusion, how quickly it ends.
You mentioned, and I'm going out on a limb, I don't know this. You actually posted something really beautiful recently on Facebook about students who were giving out dates in the old city during Ramadan to try and be good neighbors, I suppose, to our Muslim neighbors. But I also suspect now what people don't necessarily know, who don't know Judaism, is that where you teach at Yeshivat Har Etzion is a Hezder yeshiva, and Hezder means that men are studying Torah for a period, then they go into the army, they come back and study Torah. Have you lost students in the war?
Sadly, we've lost several students, some of whom I was very close with.
Can you tell us about some of them?
What's to say? The job of a teacher is to be optimistic and to dream of the future. And every child that you have the privilege and the honor to instruct and to inspire, you think of their future. I sometimes tell students in a conversation when I'm trying to help them make decisions about life, I say, I see people sitting in this corner that you can't see. Because you're 18 years old or 21 years old, but I see your wife, and I see your children, and I see your grandchildren, and they need you to make a more
Wow.
moral decision. And I'll never make the decisions for them. I'll just try to give them voices that'll help them make their decision. So every child that you, every young adult that you have the opportunity to spend time with, you dream of their future, and have that future taken is lost and it's grieving. It's incalculable compared to the loss and grieving with the families and the widows, the young widows, and little children. You certainly have to be very careful not to appropriate other people's grief, other people's tragedies. But in my own way, it's a very sad period. And we're also humbled by their courage and humbled by their determination. We thought this was a TikTok generation that was spoiled and that couldn't match the patriotism of the founding fathers. The patriotism, the Jonathan Feldsteins that moved to Israel out of nowhere. We thought this was a spoiled generation. Turns out they're pretty idealistic.
It is inspiring. Yeah. Thank you. What else before we wrap up? I always like to give guests the last word. What else do we need to know? Of course, about the book. And I'm not embarrassed at all to do a shameless plug. I don't do that often for books, but this is important because of your voice and how much I appreciate you and admire you and your ability to express this. What do other people need to know before we wrap up?
I'm grateful for your trust and your endorsement, so thank you. Everything has to be streamed through faith, and everything has to be posed to God. And asking questions is not a sign of broken faith. Asking questions means we want answers, and we expect there to be answers. If God were arbitrary, I wouldn't bother, I wouldn't waste my time asking him why. They believe God has a purpose. That purpose isn't always clear to me. But learn to live with questions. And number two, learn to live with healthy humility. I think that our world has become very cocky, very loud, very self-promotional. And when you face a tragedy of this magnitude, and the world doesn't make sense, you learn to lower your voice a little. And you learn to speak and to articulate your ideas, but with intellectual honesty and with personal humility. And that's the sign of a religious-minded person who always realizes the presence of God. There's a higher being in our world, there's a higher being in our room. He gave us creativity. He wants us to be self-expressive. He wants us to probe. He wants us to think, but always to have that healthy yin and yang, that healthy balance between confidence and between authorship and between submission to God and recognizing that you don't know
Super
it.
inspiring, Rabbi Targan. Thank you. As you were saying that, I suddenly became very envious of your students, and I just want to say thank you again for this is a super spontaneous conversation that we put together, not scripted, but really great. And I want to thank you again for making the time. It's a very busy week, and we'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you, and thank you to all the listeners. We hope come visit us in Israel. There's nothing like tasting the land, feeling the air. No better place to be right now.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, as we always wrap up for the last 3 years, I like to say in a somewhat self-deprecating way, if you've stayed with us this long, you d deserve a reward. So, since September, we have been promoting our own book. I'll have that conversation with Rabbi Targan. He hasn't seen mine yet, the Israel the Miracle, which came out 2 weeks before the war began. So, what every month, we're giving away a free copy. And all we ask that you do is like and subscribe to Inspiration from Zion on all the social media. And when you comment or share the link to this program, every month we're picking one person at random to receive a copy of Israel the Miracle. This month, it's important. We're having another conversation about another really important book relating to the war, the situation that we are, and I will acquire and offer as a gift from the Genesis 123 Foundation for another person to receive a copy of Dark Clouds Above, Faith Below, and maybe we'll even get Rabbi Tarragon to inscribe that for you. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, do pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And special thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. This episode is sponsored. I was probing a little bit to get names, Rabbi Tarragon. We're not going to mention names specifically, but in memory of the soldiers who have given their lives, whose lives were abruptly taken, and with the prayer that their families will find comfort despite the tremendous loss. And if you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd always love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and invite you to send any questions as well, specifically questions about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean mountains. God bless you.
Hallelujah, Al-Mashiach.